Hi, this is Paul. I just finished making this commentary video on Moses striking the Red Sea to blood and Jordan Peterson as a public theologian. And I stand behind my assertion that for a short list of public theologians in the English language world, Jordan Peterson has become one of the most important public theologians. Now, this is surprising because he's a psychologist. We normally wouldn't count him as a theologian. He's a strange sort of public theologian in that he's a public theologian who's also a seeker, and he says some very interesting things with respect to belief in God. In this video, I read a little bit of this article that was out of Current Magazine out of Canada, off of a speech that was given at Redeemer University, which mentioned Jordan Peterson along with this discussion of public theologians. So Peterson, and again, part of my contention is that Peterson has managed to talk about this in such a way that he actually brings it to the fore in the public conversation. And now I've got my own thoughts about the way he does this, but it works. In a lot of ways. The evasive way that he handles this question keeps people asking it. And it's sort of like Justin Brierley noting in his book that this bus campaign of atheists in the 90s about there is no God, just get on, enjoy your life, actually brought into the public consciousness the question of the existence of God. Now, part of what I want to talk about in this video is that Peterson is right in that this question is not the simple thing we imagine it to be. So let's play some of this. And Peterson will start sort of the way he usually starts to answer this question with his usual dodges.
Really believing.
Well, I gotta fix my settings.
God or not. So let's just get it on the table. Do you believe in God?
I don't think that's anybody's business. I think it's the most private question you can ask someone, but then I would say also, what's the right response to that? By their fruits you will know them.
And Pierce Morgan clearly understands that this is a direct quotation from Jesus.
How's that?
Well, let me ask you a different question. Do you think there is
now,
a...
Now, Morgan, I don't watch a lot of Pierce Morgan, but he's something else. And Peterson certainly likes him, or Peterson wouldn't have gone on the program. Peterson pretty much decides which programs he wants to go on and which ones he doesn't, and he usually goes on the programs of people that he figures aren't going to kneecap him in the way that he's been kneecapped before by some media institutions.
To God.
By their fruits you will know them. How's that?
Well, let me ask you a different question then. Do you think there is a God?
I'm terrified that there might be, Pierce. How's that? And I, you know, I'm...
See, he usually starts sort of with this, and then he goes into it. And what he says after bears listening to.
Not trying to be a smartass when I'm making that comment either. Like, they say, it's an Old Testament saying, I believe, that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And that is actually about as true a statement as you could manage in such a short phrase. And, you know, people have congratulated me. I was at the Buckley Institute last night. They were congratulating me on my courage. And I said this last night. It's like, you guys don't understand. It has nothing to do with courage. I'm just afraid of different things than the people who lie. And I'm afraid, for example, of what happens when you lose control of your tongue. And I said that back in 2016 when I first opposed the Canadian government. And people were, you know, congratulating me. It's like, well, you're so brave to stand up to the government. It's like, I'm nowhere near as afraid of the government as I am of what happens when people lose control of their tongue. I studied totalitarianism since I was 13 years old, in depth. And I know what happens when people lose control of their tongue.
Now, okay, let's get back to this public theologian question. Maybe I should just pull up the article here. The article nicely points to Reinhold Niebuhr. Now, many of you probably don't even know who Reinhold Niebuhr is. If you know the Serenity Prayer, from AA, he wrote it. Reinhold Niebuhr, in the middle of the 20th century in the United States, he was sort of the vanguard of a theological movement called Neo-Orthodoxy. In many ways, a lot of Martin Luther King Jr.'s theology was very Neo-Orthodox. Neo-Orthodoxy came on the scene earlier in the 20th century, sort of through Karl Barth, because it was felt that modernists had sort of lost their way. And so Neo-Orthodoxy was a way that people could try to apprehend crunchy biblical faith without losing status like fundamentalists and some evangelicals who believed in things like miracles and the second coming and the virgin birth and things like that, which had sort of been dismissed by, felt had been dismissed by the scientific era, and it was no longer plausible to believe in such things. Jordan Peterson, in some ways, is sort of cutting that same path in that he's cagey with respect to answers that would necessarily trap him as a fundamentalist or an evangelical. But he gives answers in such a way that leaves open the possibility of what is usually dismissed by modernism.
What happens is everything goes to hell. And I mean that metaphysically. I mean, I might even mean it theologically, but you can just say, don't even bother with that.
But what's fascinating...
Let's just mean it practically.
But what's interesting is, I completely agree with you, by the way.
See, and in some ways, that's similar to a Neo-Orthodox move. It's in some ways similar to a Barthian move, in that you can sort of avoid the fundamentalist or evangelical corner. And for this reason, a lot of people criticize him because, well, if you're going to be a real Christian, you ought to be able to get in that corner and take the blows, lose the status. But people don't generally say that to Peterson because he's clearly taking plenty of blows for other reasons. And so people aren't necessarily going to call him a coward.
And you are the most open book of almost anyone I've ever interviewed, right to the point I asked you if you believe in God. I didn't actually know what you were going to say, but for some reason you're reluctant.
I guess Piers Morgan hasn't done his homework.
To say, why are you reluctant?
Well, okay, let's walk along that. Well, because it's not a.
And again, you can find especially some speeches he gave in Australia. He seems to speak about this in Australia more than anywhere else, which is really interesting.
It's not a well-posed question. It's too complicated an issue to be dealt with like that. You step into instant traps just by accepting the question. So I'll show you what I mean.
So that, again, is sort of the move that a lot of Neo-Orthodox made, that they're going to avoid the traps, but they still want a consequential God whose commands are consequential.
Well, the first thing I would say is, what do you mean by believe? Like, do you think that a statement about the existence of God is something like a scientific theory? Do you think it's a list of facts? Is it a factual question? Does God exist or not?
Okay, so he's taking on sort of the split between the three P's, perspectival, procedural, and perspectival, procedural. I can never remember all four. Opposite of propositional.
Not? Is it a factual question like you're asking about whether a cup on a table exists, or a plate on a table, an artifact in a...
And that's not a small thing, because again, of course, what we've been talking about in this channel for a long time, God is not yet another thing in the universe. And what New Atheism did was sort of made God a super thing in the sky.
Room? What do you mean by this? What do you mean by believe? I'll stake my life on the proposition that God exists. How's that?
Bold. And clear. And, you know, it's fun when Peterson gets punchy.
Well, is that an answer? Because that's the right answer.
I would ask you, here's my supplementary. Do you ever pray?
Always.
Who do you pray to?
The spirit that protects you from hell.
But that, many people would say, is God.
Hey, sounds good to me. And so you might say, well, I said I pray always. So what does that mean? I'm trying to say the clearest words I can say. And I do that by paying attention. I'm listening to the words and feeling them as I move along, thinking, is that a firm foundation in the morass? Is that a bridge over the abyss? Is that word the right word? I do that when I'm writing.
Now, very much, again, similar to neo-orthodoxy, not so much necessarily in the content or the approach, but in wading into a culture that has been deeply impacted by existentialism. And those answers are very much sort of pitched to address existentialist dilemmas.
I do that when I'm talking. And I do that because I don't want to be in the abyss. And the pathway over the abyss is the truth. Now, with regards to belief in God, you might say, and I know that you're not particularly religiously inclined, at least that's the theory. It's like, well, you have a character, Pierce. Everyone has a character. You could say that would be the spirit of Pierce Morgan. And then we might say, well, let's inquire into that spirit. If you were a hedonist, then the spirit that would be Pierce Morgan would be your hedonistic whims. And that would be your God. I would say if you're a noble person, then your spirit is something elevated above your mere whims. And then there's the spirit that's inculcated within you. It's a consequence, perhaps, of your socialization. But in a more sophisticated way, it's actually a consequence of the spirit that you've allowed as a consequence of your choices to dwell within you. And that spirit has a nature. It might be allied with the truth. It might be allied with falsehood. If it's allied with the truth, it's a manifestation of what has been considered traditionally the logos. The more you're aligned with the truth, the more your spirit is an avatar of the logos. And that's just, it's true. It's religiously true, as it turns out, but it's also technically true. It's technically true.
See, I had a debate.
And so I'm going to...
I'm by no means an expert in neo-Orthodox theology. I'll say that right now, partly because when I went to Calvin Seminary, they did not want to deal with the neo-Orthodox. We did not read Karl Barth. If I'd gone to Western Seminary over in Holland, Michigan, we would have read a lot more Karl Barth. But in terms of understanding where the neo-Orthodox dealt with these questions and how they did, there definitely is some resonance between that. And of course, Peterson is 70 years later, you know, 60 years later than Niebuhr. But, you know, Niebuhr, I mean, again, the guy who writes the Serenity Prayer. Now there's a deeply impactful application. But the ironic thing, and maybe this is partly due to Aaron Wren's positive, neutral, and negative world, maybe Jordan Peterson is a public theologian for the negative world.
I'm making that case in the new book.
Right. So I had a debate with Richard Dawkins about this, who was a bit disingenuous with me because he sat with me for a whole show, seemed to enjoy it, thanked me very much for it, and then called me a fool afterwards in some podcast. So I know you've had a few run-ins with him, and it doesn't surprise me. But what I said to Dawkins was, because I was raised a Catholic, I was given spiritual guidance for several years by Catholic nuns, and I do believe in God. And the reason I said to him is that no human brain can really explain to me, or anybody, what was there before nothing. So if you believe in a Big Bang Theory, well, what was there before that? Because I don't think any human brain has that power to explain or answer that question, to me it makes perfect sense. There should be some being, entity, something, which is superior to a human brain. And I would think that someone with your brain would think that too, because there are questions we simply can't answer.
Okay. Okay, three things about that. So the first is, that's the argument by design, that things are so complex and sophisticated that cries out for the hypothesis of something like a creator. I'm not a big fan of the argument by design.
Which is really fascinating.
see its advantages, but it isn't the primary argument as far as I'm concerned. So the Big Bang proponents have a problem because it's a tenet of the Big Bang theory that the laws of physics themselves break down at the point of the singularity, and that would be the point just before the Big Bang. And when you say the laws of physics, the existence of space and time even, is an unknowable prior to the Big Bang, you're basically
And he's made this argument for a number of years now.
Visiting a miracle at the beginning of existence, and so if you get to have your miracle, there's no reason the religious types can't have theirs. You might argue about what the miracle needs to be, and I think that's an argument that has to be had. I don't like the argument by design. I like the argument by conscience better. So the argument by
If you read Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis's book, C.S. Lewis begins that book with the argument for conscience, basically saying that people might differ on what they believe is right and wrong, but very few dismiss that there is a right and wrong and sort of a moral realism.
Conscience, which is another string of classic theological thought, is that something dwells within you that aligns you with the spirit of reality. And it's the still small voice within that was identified first by the prophet Elijah.
And again, I with the controversial video I made about the woman at the tech conference and the little talk she made, he does take now the contemporary turn inside rather than up and out, which is interesting to note.
And it was part of a transformation in the religious viewpoint in historical terms that moved the notion of God from something like Baal, B-A-A-L, a nature god, the god of storms and earthquakes, of what would you say, remarkable and awe-inspiring natural phenomena, to the voice within that can, if you attend to it, align you with the structure of reality itself, that internal voice being a manifestation of God. And I think that's an extremely powerful argument. And I think it's right. And I'll tell you something about Dawkins' work that's very interesting. So,
and it's so interesting because at the beginning he's very cagey, and now he's just, you know, giving it out right here. But again, he's giving it out in a way that transcends these the sort of battleground that was left with a decade of yes or no about God that sort of marked the evangelical, non-evangelical sphere.
Dawkins has pointed out that an organism has to be a microcosm of its environment in order to survive. And I would say the voice of conscience within us is the most unerring manifestation of the microcosm within. And I think you can make an extraordinarily powerful biological case for that. And I've done that in this new book. So I think Dawkins' argument invalidates his epistemology.
Yeah, I agree.
I really believe that.
But what do you think? I mean, you've had moments.
Did Pierce actually understand what he said? Yeah, I agree. It's like, you know, but what Peterson just said there is kind of a lot. And we're very much going to want to read the book and get a sense of it. But yeah, I agree. Okay.
In your life in recent years, well, I would imagine you have face the prospect of potentially dying. And in those moments, what have you felt, and what do you think happens to you? If you do die, or you had died, what did you imagine might happen to you?
Well, I had lots of moments, years in the last few years where dying would have been an absolute relief. And had that been accompanied by the complete cessation of my being, I would have been perfectly content with that. There are things that are far worse than dying. So if you're only terrified of dying, you've hardly begun to plumb the depths of existential catastrophe.
death is fairly...
You just don't have an imagination.
What could be worse than dying?
Well, you know, it's funny that he says that because, of course, I think as a culture, we are continuing to grapple with the question of suicide. And suicide, of course, is where people make the choice that dying is better than living. But, you know, Morgan, this is an excellent interview. I mean, he is a cagey interviewer. He really is. I mean, he's not pulling punches, and he has a way of asking these questions in a you know, it's don't sit across from this guy too readily and not think it through.
Being a prison guard at Auschwitz?
But you'd still be alive, even if you were witnessing horror. It's not death that the...
After all the nice things I said about him, it's almost like you're still not getting it, are you?
Oh, no. I'm thinking perpetrating it.
Right. You mean...
How about being an Auschwitz guard? How about being an Auschwitz guard who really enjoyed his job? How about that? That's worse than death, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
I mean that.
No, I see that.
That's hell, man.
Yeah, it's a living hell.
That's hell.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think think there's an actual hell, Jordan? Is there somewhere that people like that go to, which is hell?
Oh, definitely. Now, what relationship that has to what happens to you when you die, I have no idea. I mean, I don't think anybody's in a position to speak about what's truly beyond our ken, let's say. I don't think we understand consciousness at all. We don't understand time. We don't understand the relationship between finitude and the infinite landscape that surrounds us. That's all a great mystery, and I tend to leave that alone because I try not to speak about things that I can't speak about. But does hell exist? It's like, study history and see if you can figure it out for yourself.
I mean, does heaven
there's
exist?
Nothing. There's nothing that's more obvious than that hell exists.
It should be noted that when Jesus talked, this brings up the whole universalist conversation, which is a very big one in this corner. But when Jesus, in the New Testament, the two words that come up that are usually translated as hell into English Bibles are Hades. So if you look at the story of Lazarus and the rich man goes to Hades, and Hades can have different levels, and also Gehenna, which is the Valley of Hinnom outside of Israel, which had been a place where ancient kings had burned their children and was used as a garbage dump. And so, you know, I know people might be thinking Jordan is being evasive here, but not necessarily.
But does heaven exist?
Mao's China was hell.
Right, but so you're talking about hell on Earth, but do you believe there's a hell after death?
Like I said, I can't. I don't speculate about such things. I don't. That's where my ignorance finds its. What would you say? That's where my knowledge finds its limit. I'm concerned enough about what I'm doing right now, right here, and.
And so again, Jordan has a particular sort of natural theology in that he has, right when he says, do you believe in God, that's too personal. So does he have speculations and ideas about these other things? Probably. Is he going to talk about them publicly? No. Well, why not? Because I think he wants to, this is all part of his idea about how he should use language and speech, and that he wants to speak as a psychologist. And I mean, there's a lot of caginess to this, but if you sort of understand what he's doing, again, there is a degree of alignment with something like neo-orthodoxy, which is really interesting.
And leaving the rest of that, and you know, I have to leave it at that. The hell that I see as a potential on Earth is sufficient as a deterrent, and it's of sufficient reality. You know, you can ask, well, is it eternal? Well, I would say, well, look, all totalitarian states are variants on a theme, let's say, and that theme persists. All archetypal stories are eternal. Everything that happened in the Bible happened and is happening and will continue to happen forever. It's part of the...
And that, of course, informs, if you listen carefully to his biblical lectures, what he just said here is pervasive through it.
Eternal human story. It's hyper-real. And heaven and hell are part of that. Mm. What that means in the final analysis, I don't know. I mean, you asked in there, you know, hell is real, is heaven real? It's like, well, heaven is as far away from hell as you can get. That's a good way of thinking about
right.
it. I've spent my whole life trying to determine how you get as far away from being a camp guard at Auschwitz who enjoys his job as possible. And one of the things I've realized in recent years, for example, is that you are far from that if you're engaging in your interactions with the world in the spirit of voluntary play. You know, and we're playing during this conversation, and Joe Rogan plays on his podcast all the time. And if you're in a playful state with your wife, your marriage is optimized. And the state of play is the opposite of tyranny. And that's why it says in the Gospels that if you want to enter the kingdom of heaven, you have to become like a little child. So you want to reinstate that open-eyed, wide-eyed acceptance of life that is the precursor to voluntary play. You want to develop your character to the point where that's part and parcel of your life on an ongoing basis. And that's allowing that spirit of the Logos to inhabit you. That's another way of thinking about it. And you can certainly aid that with prayer. You know, people don't...
This is public theology. He's being asked to answer these questions. Now, of course, public theology is always debated, but this is public theology. He is a public theologian, and he has a platform unlike any other religious figure. Now, Rick Warren, before Obergefell, sort of flips things and took a lot of evangelicals and non-same-sex marriage-affirming Christians out of the public space. Well, you know, someone might argue, well, Rick Warren, he prayed at Obama's first inaugural. And Giglio, of course, got in trouble because they decided to not platform him at Obama's second inaugural. But I think it's really hard to argue that there is another public theologian who's got a higher profile and is in many ways more influential right now than Jordan Peterson. And I know that bothers a lot of Christians, certain kinds of Christians especially. And there's obviously a culture war valence to this. But who's on the other side? Oprah?
Don't understand. People think of God as, the joke is, a cosmic butler. You pray to have your wishes granted. It's like, he's not a genie. You want to pray? It's like, pray about your stupidity. Here's a prayer that'll work for sure. You want to see if prayer works? Here's one. This'll work. Sit on the edge of your bed. Ask yourself, what bloody stupid thing do I continue to do that's making my life more miserable than it has to be, and everyone else's life around me, that I could give up, that I would give up? But you have to really want the answer. So you open yourself up in humility to a revelation. You'll get an answer.
Is the Serenity Prayer practical? Is what he's saying here now practical?
It won't be when you want. That's how you'll know it's true. But if you act on it, then your life will improve. And that's a proper prayer.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Like, in a metaphysical sense, the Christian insistence that you should be aware of your sins, you know, which is in a sense an existential burden, is also the idea that you should attend to your own inadequacies and admit to them, because in doing so, you open up the possibility that something better can make itself manifest within you. And there's no doubt that that's the case. That's for sure, that's true. But you have to do it in humility. And you have to be looking. That's why you're supposed to take the mote out of your own eye instead of worrying about the beam in your neighbor's eye. It's like...
This is public theology. It's what it is.
There's something about you that's stupid you could fix. Yeah. And God will tell you what it is if you want him to, so to speak.
There you go. You know, I make these videos and I usually find some things that I think are interesting that would be fun to talk about. Things that I've watched at least once or twice, and I thought, this is important. I want to sort of, and I usually have an idea of where I'm going to go with it, but I never really know. And this was kind of surprising. I'm sure when I write it, there's a lot of smart people in the corner who know a lot of theology, and it'll be kind of a debate, but yeah, it's an interesting thought. So can't wait to hear what you have to say about it.